Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. This is our Friday morning news roundup. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, after a final day of questioning what happens next in the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump, will there be witness testimony? And when all is said and done, how will history remember the role of Utah's senators? Also, the resignation, or was it ouster, of Salt Lake City School Superintendent Lexi Cunningham, the lawsuit filed over the law enforcement raid at the home of a Salt Lake City family, and Uinta County becomes the first county in Utah to declare itself a sanctuary county for the Second Amendment. Those and other stories on the docket today, and joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Thanks for joining me, Matt.
Good morning.
Glad you're here. Also in studio with us is reporter Taylor Stevens. Thanks for being here, Taylor.
Good morning.
And on the phone from Washington, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Thomas, thanks as well to you.
Thank you.
And listeners, you are invited to join this discussion. You can call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK to offer your questions or comments. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Thomas Burr joining us again from the Capitol. The past few days in the Senate impeachment trial of the president have been about questions being asked back and forth between impeachment managers acting as prosecutors and then the president's counsel on the defense. There's a lot we could unpack from this week, including some shifting arguments from the defense over the president's actions. But where we are headed next is a vote later today on whether witnesses will be called during the trial. Mitt Romney says he'd like that to happen, but he's just one senator potentially dissenting from the majority. I guess, Tommy, where are we in all of this?
Sure, and I think we're still kind of figuring that out. This is what I'm guessing is going to happen from what we've seen so far. Mitt Romney said this morning that he is going to vote for witnesses. He'll be joined by Susan Collins of Maine, who has also said she wants to hear witnesses. Possibly Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. All three of those are Republicans who will be joining with the 47 Democrats and Independents. So that would put us at a 50-50 tie at that situation on whether to call witnesses. That vote is in about 6 hours or so away. What we don't think is going to happen is actually have witnesses, because Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, the senator, said that he thinks what the president did was wrong, but it doesn't, you know, come up to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, and that he doesn't think witnesses will change anyone's mind. So really what we're looking at is possibly today an actual vote on to convict or acquit the president. With the majority Republican chamber, we're going to likely see the president acquitted later today.
And that's the end of the impeachment trial, just like that.
Yeah, and it could things can change. It's all very fluid right now, and this vote could come down at 3-4 in the morning, early tomorrow, Eastern time. So we'll see how many roadblocks Democrats want to put up with other votes, and see if they can get any Republicans to ply any Republicans away to come their way. But yes, it looks like after several months of the House investigating and then voting to impeach, and then the Senate trial, which has lasted a little less than 2 weeks, we could be coming to the end soon.
The 50-50 split you just mentioned on the question of allowing witnesses in this trial, does that mean anything, or is it just an automatic fail? What happens with the 50-50 split?
Well, I'm not a constitutional expert, but I have stayed at a Holiday Inn once upon a time, so I can now explain that what I know is when it comes to a 50-50 split, usually the vice president can break the tie, either one way or the other. In this situation, Mike Pence can't actually break that tie because, one, it kind of would put him in the Oval Office potentially if they do eventually convict. But the Chief Justice is presiding over the Senate trial, and there's a question of whether Chief Justice John Roberts could actually vote. It's likely he's not going to step into that situation, so a 50-50 vote fails.
There have to be, as you said, four Republicans who choose to not fall in line with the party asking them to go against this for this to happen, and there are barring some unknown wild card, you have Mitt Romney from Utah, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, and then Senator Susan Collins of Maine, as you pointed out. And why those three say that they want witnesses has to do with some recent revelations having to do with former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton. And actually, Tommy, if you can hang on for a second, we've got a clip here of Senator Murkowski This is her question. Actually, it's not her, but it's her question from yesterday that explains this. This is Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski's question read by John Roberts, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, yesterday on the Senate floor. Take a quick listen.
Senator Murkowski asks counsel for the president. You explained that Ambassador Sondland and Senator Johnson both said the president explicitly denied that he was looking for a quid pro quo with Ukraine. The reporting on Ambassador Bolton's book suggests the president told Bolton directly that the aid would not be released until Ukraine announced the investigations the president desired. This dispute about material facts weighs in favor of calling additional witnesses with direct knowledge. Why should this body not call Ambassador Bolton?
And the answer by the president's counsel was basically because the House, you know, hadn't gone through the process of offering a subpoena to or making John Bolton appear. And so that was the process that they were supposed to go through, according to the counsel for the president. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton, in a forthcoming book, apparently says the president told me directly there was quid pro quo here. Tommy, is that what Senator Romney is also pointing to for why he wants to see John Bolton testify?
Yes, and I think that's the argument that the Democrats have made, and Romney's made from the start that he thinks this is very interesting and goes to the heart of the matter, that right to the center of the impeachment inquiry and the questions of abuse of power or obstruction of Congress. Is Bolton saying, hey, I was that firsthand witness, I saw it, and Romney thinks that the Senate ought to hear from that. If there is testimony out there, bring it in and not just you know, hide it away that it's going to come out eventually. You know, he does want to publish a book at some point. So the argument will be that, you know, we should hear from this. The Republican counter is we've already heard, you know, plenty of testimony. The Democrats say their case is overwhelming. And if they had other testimony, they should have brought it up in the House, and then we wouldn't have to be, you know, doing their homework in the Senate. It has been interesting, too, to see the White House counsel's response, because it's changed over time. And the White House's response was, you know, originally, you know, there's no quid pro quo. Then it changed to, if there was, it's not a problem. Alan Dershowitz, one of the president's lawyers, this week was essentially saying, you know, even if there was, you know, a quid pro quo, if the president believed it was in the public interest that it would help him get reelected, and that's in the public interest, then that's okay. So it's kind of shifted over time. I'm not sure how many senators buy the it's okay if it's, you know, helps the president get reelected line, but that's one of the ones they made.
I mean, the this for that quid pro quo, the president, I mean, over and over again has said no quid pro quo himself, you know, and we have John Bolton apparently in a book coming out saying otherwise. Lawyers for the president, though, as you said, they're not disputing that happened, that the president, you know, didn't pressure Ukraine for his own personal and political gain, or that, you know, he didn't obstruct justice. Are they saying that he didn't do what is alleged, I guess, is what I'm asking, Tommy?
Or explaining away and saying essentially, well, you know, even if there is one, if his motivation was not necessarily just his personal interest, that he believes there's a public interest, that it would be good for America if he was reelected, and why not, you know, get this information out, that it would be good for America to know if the Bidens did anything wrong. By the way, there's been much of that has been debunked, and there's nothing proven that Joe Biden or his son did anything wrong. But Trump's saying, and his lawyers are saying, well, even if he did, it's okay because it helps America. That's a line that has shifted, like I was saying, and we'll see what happens. Again, we see most senators towing the line right here. The Democrats, all 47 of them, including two independents, are, you know, going to likely vote to convict the president. And then we have on the Republican side 53 senators who were likely to acquit. Now, I will put a little asterisk there. There's a few people like Joe Manchin of West Virginia who may vote, you know, for the abuse of power article but against the obstruction of Congress or somewhere like that to give the president his bipartisan win.
Hmm. Okay. I want to bring Matt Canham, senior managing editor of the Tribune, in on this. And Matt, I mean, do you want to talk about what's happening here at all? We've got I have to wonder a little bit about how history is going to look back on this moment in time. And it sounds like from what Tommy is describing that Senator Mitt Romney is taking that long view as well, trying to make a case for himself choosing to vote in favor of country over what the rest of his party is doing. Country over party, I guess, is the sort of shorthand for that. What do you see here, Matt?
I think Senator Mitt Romney is in a unique position as someone who is not looking at a long political career in front of him. He's near the end of his career. And I think that gives him a freedom to look at the issue in front of him and make a decision independent of his party. And I think that might be playing a part in this. I don't know if, him voting for witnesses, we'll see what he does on the actual, the final vote on whether to acquit the president or not. But I do think it's possible that he would consider voting to actually remove the president, though, I mean, he hasn't really hinted at that. At least I don't know if he has. Tommy probably has better information there.
Tommy, do you have any beat on whether or not aside from this one vote coming up on witnesses, Romney might take a more radical stance than the rest of his party on impeachment itself?
We haven't seen much of an inkling of that just so far, but Senator Romney has been keeping a lot of this close to the vest. I mean, he kept saying all week, for example, that he would like to hear John Bolton testify, but until this morning, he did not say that he would vote for John Bolton to testify. So I think we're a few steps removed to see where Romney would go, but that would be a big step for the senator, who, of course, is not a big fan of the president, but also doesn't want to create enemies. But it'd be a big move to have him vote to convict the president, and would pretty much alienate him from the White House and a lot of his fellow Republicans for the rest of his, at least the rest of this year.
Okay. Tommy, I know we have to let you go here momentarily, but this thing sounds like it's going to possibly wrap up today, barring that wild card on witnesses, and then the president gets acquitted by the Senate on the last day of January of 2020. Is that, not that you make predictions, but this is what we're looking at, if unless there's a tiebreaker vote that goes against or that allows witnesses to testify.
Or procedural measures.
Oh, yeah, right.
I wish I could predict. But just seeing how this plays out today will be depend on how much sleep I get tonight, I guess. In essence, what we're going to look at is a vote first. There's a debate, then we're going to vote on whether it should be witnesses or not, and then they're going to vote to proceed possibly to the final vote, and then they'll eventually have the final vote. But in between, we could have Democrats throwing up individual motions. You know, should we call John Bolton as a witness? Should we call Mick Mulvaney as a witness? Should we call so-and-so? And the Republicans may counter with, we should have Hunter Biden testify. So we could have multiple repeated votes throughout the night. Like I say, it could wrap up, 3-4 in the morning on, that would be February 1st. Or we could bump it to Monday again. It's one of those things where we know the score at the end of the football game, but we don't know how many overtimes it's going to take to get there.
Okay. Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief with the Salt Lake Tribune, we really appreciate you taking the time to bring us the story, and good luck covering an interesting moment in history there in Washington.
Thanks.
We're going to take a quick break here on Behind the Headlines, and there's more from this past week's news to cover on the show, including the pro-gun stance that one county in Utah just adopted. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens and senior managing editor Matt Canham. You are listening to our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, we'll turn now to some more recent news. It's not recent. This is the impeachment is very recent, actually. I don't know why I'm saying that. This is a story that you reported just yesterday, though, and we've heard the term sanctuary city used a lot in reference to immigration, to cities being a welcoming place for immigrants. The story that you wrote is about a sanctuary county, not for people, but for guns, or for the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution anyway. This is Uinta County. What is it that Uinta County is doing?
Yeah, so this happened Wednesday, as you said, becoming the first sanctuary county for the Second Amendment. And what that means is that the government has said it won't recognize or enforce some federal or state regulations restricting a person's right to bear arms. They say that those regulations need to be narrowly tailored and in line with the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings on gun control, and anything that they feel falls outside of that realm, now people in Uinta County do not have to comply with. Uinta County will not be putting any of its resources financially or employee-wise into enforcing any of those rules that they see as outside of the bounds of this ordinance.
And are these rules that actually exist, or are they rules that are theoretical future rules?
Theoretical. They see this as a preventative measure, and they were inspired to do this by Virginia, which this sort of movement has cropped up in Virginia to pass this kind of Second Amendment sanctuary in, I believe, around 120 towns, cities, and counties. And what happened there is that the Democrats took control of their state house and introduced a slate of gun control measures that some of these communities found didn't, you know, fit with their views, and they wanted to kind of, in Virginia at least, sort of set that tone. Here in Utah, where we have a, you know, conservative legislature, I think they see it as maybe a little more unlikely that some of these would come into play. However, they wanted to kind of set the tone. They see themselves as a leader on this issue and sort of send a message to the state and the federal government that here's what we believe, and, you know, these are the rights that we believe we're owed under the Constitution.
Okay, so Uinta County becomes the first county in Utah to have this sanctuary county status for the Second Amendment. And there's one county in, or there are, I guess, all of Virginia. Are there other places around the country that are following suit, that are doing this as well?
Yeah, so this has been approved in more than 20 states and I believe around 400 municipalities. And in Utah, you know, locally, we have seen some cities and counties using this sanctuary idea recently. Kind of couple of counties and cities have become sanctuary cities for the unborn. Utah County is one. But those are resolutions, and so they more send a statement of values that, you know, this is what we believe as a community, whereas this is an actual ordinance. This is, you know, 5 pages inserted into their county code, and so a little bit different than just kind of a value statement.
This contrasts pretty starkly with some news, you know, that has been breaking, or that has that you've reported on here along the Wasatch Front. Salt Lake County Mayor Jenny Wilson took some action on guns recently, but more on the gun control side of things. Can you tell us about her actions?
Yeah, earlier this month, she announced that she was doing an executive order to require gun shows in county-operated facilities to conduct federal background checks, kind of trying to close that gun show loophole. So it's interesting that these two actions are taking place, you know, Uinta County, just a few hours northeast of Salt Lake County, and yet we're seeing very different county responses to this issue, sort of as gun control has become such a big issue nationwide amid all these shootings that we've been seeing, mass shootings. So it's interesting to see kind of one of the more liberal counties, probably the most liberal county in the state, go one way and another go a completely different direction.
Meanwhile, at the sort of overarching state level, at the legislature, another Democrat, Representative Brian King, is running his own gun reform bill this year. What's that about?
Yeah, so he proposed this last year and it died without a hearing. Basically, this is a universal background check bill. And, you know, I think a lot of people thought that if the time for that bill was going to be last year, when there was a lot of movement around Parkland and young voices getting in the conversation around gun control, and that bill didn't go anywhere. So, you know, we'll see what happens in the legislature. No bill is dead until it's over, but it's early days.
I mean, the fact that, I mean, what you're hinting at and not saying as a reporter is that it seems very unlikely to pass. And that makes me wonder about the, you know, this Uinta County measure. Is it needed? I guess, are there going to be rule changes that Uinta County is even preventatively dealing with? I mean, you're in Utah. It's a pretty gun-friendly state. Maybe I'll bring Matt Canham, senior managing editor, on this. Has there been any noticeable shift in public policy on guns in Utah?
Not in Utah, and not nationally either. Though, you know, this is clearly a message move. But what you're pointing out is it could have ramifications in the future. Just because of what's happening in politics today does not mean that's what's going to happen in politics tomorrow. And so we might have a new administration after this election. We could have different change in politics in Washington. And there is obviously on the Democratic side a lot of interest in different gun laws. So this could be something where Uinta County does have a conflict with the federal government, which seems more likely than, say, a conflict with the state government, where we've seen for a number of years Utah's legislature is not inclined to do a lot when it comes to changing gun laws.
And I'm sure that, right, there's probably specific measures that are more likely to pass than other broader gun reform measures, but we don't have to get into the what's likely or not likely to pass. I want to remind listeners that you can join the conversation by calling 801-355-8255. You can tweet to us as well. Our handle here is at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, anything we're missing on this story?
Yeah, I'll just run quickly through some of the provisions that they've outlined that would be considered an unlawful act. One would be a tax, a levy, a fee, a stamp imposed on guns or gun accessories that's not applied to other goods. Another would be registration or tracking of firearms and ammunition not at the point of sale. Any restrictions limiting magazine or clip capacity, bump stock, suppressors, etc. So they in their ordinance outline a few kind of examples of things that they would not comply with.
Not comply with, but I mean, does it mean that they would fund lawyers to challenge those statutes, or they would just go against the law? At some point, that sounds like you are. Can your resolution or your message? Sanctuary county status actually prevent you from adhering to laws that may get passed?
Well, they have made it a Class B misdemeanor for any employee to put resources, whether that's, you know, as an employee going out to enforce those or putting any financial resources into enforcing those rules. So they were clear to say, you know, this isn't just a message. This has some teeth to it.
I feel like I need a legal scholar here, because it seems, Matt Cannon, do you have any thoughts on whether or not a county could just, you know, say no to federal rules on or federal laws on any kind of?
We have other examples of this. This is obviously built off of more liberal cities proclaiming themselves sanctuary cities against federal immigration law,
right,
and having police chiefs say they're not going to work with federal agents. We also have 33 states that have medical marijuana laws, if not recreational marijuana laws, which violate federal law. So there are times where there are conflicts between the local government and the federal government. How much that becomes a friction point, I guess it depends on the actions of both sides that want to make an issue of this. So while my hunch would be this would be a message piece of legislation that I would not be surprised if other Utah counties follow suit. I don't know if it will actually lead to conflict, just like we don't see the federal government leading to much conflict with medical marijuana.
Got it. Okay, that's Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. I want to turn now to some other news from this past week and stick with Taylor Stevens. Another story that you reported, this one on a lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Utah and others over a law enforcement raid on a Salt Lake City family with some allegations of violence and illegal acts by these law enforcement officials. And I'll ask you just to lay this out for us. A family here in Salt Lake City in the Rose Park neighborhood, what happened to them?
Yeah, so the Yanez family, the lawsuit contends that they were sitting down for dinner when AP&P, Adult Probation and Parole, officers came to the door. They were looking for the family's, one of their adult sons, who was allegedly in violation of his parole. The family, which speaks Spanish, responded that the adult son wasn't there. This, I believe, was their third interaction with AP&P, letting them know that they didn't know where the son was, that he wasn't in the home. After some back and forth, and there is some video associated with this, you can see on our website as well, that the ACLU released in conjunction with this lawsuit. The video shows some back and forth, and the family keeps asking for a warrant, and they want to see a warrant before they'll let the officers into their home, a search warrant. The officers say they don't need one and proceed later to break down both the back and front doors simultaneously and enter the home. The lawsuit alleges that they tased the father of the family, that they handcuffed the mother, handcuffed several of the minors. There were three minors in the home, three adults, and kind of detail some of the things that happened throughout the raid as well.
And again, the purpose of this raid was to capture, will you explain what the purpose of the raid is one more time?
Yeah, the purpose of the raid was to find the adult son who had allegedly violated his parole. However, the lawsuit speculates that the raid was part of this pattern of AP&P allowing bail bond agent company agents to co-opt their tactical teams in search of fugitives that would cost them money. So that's their allegation. And I should note that the Utah Department of Corrections and Adult Probation and Parole did not respond to our request for comment. They said they were not able to comment on ongoing litigation, so we don't have the other side of this. But the lawsuit alleges a few other, aside from an illegal search, a few other abuses.
Right.
It says that one or multiple agents stole about $7,000 the family had saved for their daughter's quinceañera. That agents had pointed a gun at one of the minors and that they made several racist comments. The lawsuit also alleges that this was a racially motivated and racially biased invasion of the home.
Just these agencies, the two that you mentioned who conducted this raid, I am not very familiar with. One of them I had never heard of before. And can you tell us what their sort of role in and I guess legal what they are allowed to do, what they get to go out and do. I mean, they can conduct raids like this. They are just another law enforcement agency, another police agency.
Well, so they have they had an arrest warrant for the adult son, Jose, but they did not have a search warrant. And so they contend, I believe, that the arrest warrant with the address, this address was enough, while the family says, you know, they needed a search warrant that would explicitly authorize them to enter the home. And the family says they'd had multiple interactions with adult probation, which, you know, is there to kind of keep people under the terms of their probation, that he had not lived in the residence since the summer of 2017. So there's some, differences in what they say they need versus what the ACLU of Utah believes they need, and that will be sorted out by the courts.
And what sort of damages are they seeking? I mean, are they asking for, I would imagine, at least the $7,000 that they say was stolen for this quinceañera. What else are they asking? What are they seeking?
They mostly want policy changes to prevent a raid like this from happening to anyone else in the state. They believe there was a conspiracy to violate their civil rights. And in interviews with the ACLU of Utah, the family talks about, you know, this feeling that they were discriminated against and that their community was discriminated against. And they don't want that to happen to others who might be in a similar situation of, being immigrants. They were U.S. citizens, but, you know, being in that kind of vulnerable situation of not speaking the language of the majority of people in the state, you know, some of those challenges of not knowing the culture and the community, they don't want to see this sort of incident and this trauma that they say they experienced to happen to other families.
Okay. There's video footage of this, as you said, and it comes from both a cell phone video footage that the family took and then also some body cam footage, is that right?
So we have not seen any body cam footage. We have seen two videos that the Yanez family took during the raid.
It's pretty disturbing footage. You can check it out in Taylor's story at sltrib.com. I want to actually just quickly, unless there's anything else you want to add on that story, Taylor, I want to circle back to something that we were talking about before, because we had a comment from a listener, Thomas Elder Jr., who says, commenting on the story that we were just talking about before this, which is the Uinta County becoming a sanctuary county for guns. He writes, "This is not a good thing. Uinta County faces an uncertain economic future and will need to encourage entrepreneurs and new residents to move in. This declares to the world, quote, we are a fringe community with extremist views, unquote." And that's about Uinta County's new rule, I guess, or new law declaring it a sanctuary county for the Second Amendment. You can weigh in on the stories that we've been talking about as well by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our hashtag is, our handle is at KCPW. Matt Canham, any comments on this story, on this raid, and the lawsuit that the ACLU of Utah and others are filing on behalf of this family before we head to a break?
I'd just say it's obviously a tragic thing, and it shows the intersection of, you know, major police powers and the impact it can have on people. So we'll see what happens with the lawsuit.
Okay. That is Matt Canham. You've been hearing also from Taylor Stevens, who is a reporter with Salt Lake Tribune. Matt Canham is senior managing editor. We are going to take another quick break in the show. There's still more to come, though, including the retirement of a school superintendent. We'll also dip into the story of a well-connected company involved in renewable energy credits, or a renewable energy credits scam, that is. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham and Taylor Stevens. It's our Friday morning news roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255, or again, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right, well, the pending departure of the superintendent of Salt Lake City Schools, this is Lexi Cunningham, who announced her retirement last week. But it turns out it's not exactly a choice that she's making, or at least that's what we believe. Matt Canham, senior managing editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. What happened here? And maybe you can give us the backstory as well, because that is part of this.
There's a whole lot of drama happening in the Salt Lake City School District right now. This district is led by seven people. Last week, from our understanding, is they had a closed-door meeting where they made it clear that they were going to fire the superintendent, Lexi Cunningham, who has served in that position for 4 years, as well as the business administrator, Janet Roberts, who's been in the district for 30 years. And in reaction, both Ms. Cunningham and Ms. Roberts turned in the resignation effective at the end of the year. One board member is the only one who would talk to us, is a supporter of Lexi Cunningham. His name's Michael Nemelka. He represents some west side area of the city. And he said that four members of this board have been out to get the superintendent for years. They've been just not happy with her performance, have demanded that she fire 16 principals and that she refused to do it, and have had enough, and they are forcing her out. But we don't really have their side of it. The four board members who are the ones driving this decision have not returned our calls. They held a quick meeting yesterday, all of it within closed session, and then told reporter Courtney Tanner that they would be issuing no comment afterward.
Okay. Sorry, just the something that stuck in my head there that I hadn't dug into when I read the story was the request to fire 16 principals. That seems like a lot of people to ask someone to fire. Do you know what the reasoning behind that was?
And that's what we don't know. And that's the hard part, is when you have limited information about such big decisions, you're left to make conclusions without having all the information. Michael Nemelka said that they wanted her to fire 16 principals district-wide, and he called that an idiotic suggestion. But he also is a self-proclaimed supporter of the superintendent. It's clear that this school district has had some issues. One of the ones that was most striking for many parents is its after-school program, which was understaffed. They didn't tell parents about it until only 3 weeks before the school year began, which meant parents had to scramble to find a place for their kids to go after school for some sort of daycare.
Because some were canceled, or some there wasn't enough room.
Number of spots were removed. It seems like that's something you would know you were underfunded well in advance, and the school district did not help parents in that one. So that was a big one. We also had an incident in West High,
right,
where the principal, a very popular principal named Ford White, helped two drunk teenage students get home. He drove them home, and he was put on leave because that violated school policy. The district expected him to call the police in that matter, and he did not. And he has been left in limbo for 2 months. Supposedly, these four district board members who wanted the superintendent gone also wanted her to take action on Ford White's suspension, and she did not. Yesterday, they took that action, and that principal has been fired.
Yeah, fired the principal of West High. There's a really interesting story from Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner about the firing of that.
It's fascinating.
That principal, because he describes a number of crises that were happening the day of him. This is from his perspective, very specifically.
So yeah. Courtney Tanner talked to Ford White last night. First time he has given an interview in this process. And he said that in this supposed investigation of that incident, he was never talked to by the school board. And that he says if they did talk to him, he would say that he had to make a lot of rapid fire decisions. And that what happened with those two teenage girls should be put in context with what else was happening at the school. He said there was a student who he was told had suicidal thoughts, and that one of the students found a note that threatened a school shooting. There were actions happening that he saw also some boys that he had banned from campus because one of them assaulted a teacher on campus again. And so he had to go deal with that. And he said in the chaos of it all, he made a decision and that should be put into context.
And the decision was, again, to drive two students that he found when he actually went out to confront the people coming back on campus who weren't allowed there, who were visibly intoxicated, I guess.
Yeah.
And to try and drive them home.
There were two students who were sharing a bottle of rum, and they were very, very drunk. And he decided to get them home. We've talked to those students. We're not using their names in this story. They're underage. They're not charged with a crime. But they said that what he did was an act of mercy. What the district said is what he did was violating policy.
Okay, and there was a walkout by students in support of him. He's now been fired, as you said. What, just out of curiosity, what is that one principal out of, you know, maybe 16 others who conceivably could be at risk in the school district? But what is he doing now?
Well, he has a decision to make. He's been working part time doing handyman work to afford his legal fees. He can appeal his firing. He can fight this. We don't know. It does not appear from the story that Courtney wrote last night that we know whether he's going to make that decision or not.
Okay. Okay. Well, just on the story, going back to Lexi Cunningham and her having been being, I guess, sort of forced out. She's announced a retirement that is pending at the end of the year. Is that what you said of this coming year?
Yes.
I mean, this year, 2020.
Yes. She's her resignation is at the end of the year. She has applied for other positions throughout the last year and was a finalist for two of them. So it's not completely out of the blue that she'll be leaving, even though we didn't know about this conflict behind the scenes, or at least it wasn't as public as it is now. She is setting this up as she is moving on to pursue another educational opportunity. So we fully expect Lexi Cunningham to find a job as a superintendent somewhere. She came to Utah as the superintendent of the Peoria Unified School District in Arizona, and she had applied to positions in Florida and elsewhere. So I'm sure she's on the hunt for another job.
Okay. All right. A reminder to listeners, again, you can join us 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments about any of the stories we're covering today.
Can I just make a quick correction?
Go ahead.
Sure. I named the wrong school district. She was a finalist for a job at Peoria.
Okay.
She worked at another Arizona district.
Okay. Got it. 801-355-8255 to join this conversation, or tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW. Matt Canham, I want to turn now to one more story, and this has to do with Washakie Renewable Energy. It's a renewable energy, it would seem, in name only. There's been a fraud case. And what I actually want to ask about is a donation that the company made to Utah's attorney general. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke drew some attention to that donation this week. Maybe you could kind of give us, it's an in-depth story.
I'm going to give it a shot.
The background and then also this donation to the attorney general.
You might remember the name Washakie Renewable Energy because in the middle of 2010s, somewhere in the middle there, they just lavished millions of dollars in advertising, largely through Utah Jazz Games and the Larry H. Miller companies, to promote themselves to this renewable energy company. They are owned by the Kingston Polygamous Group, sometimes referred to as the Order. The Kingston Polygamous Group, what they did is they were supposed to take used cooking oil and turn it into renewable energy. And when they did that, they got a kickback from the government, federal government, to support this renewable energy. Well, what our government has alleged, and what at least four of the defendants have pled guilty to, is that it was all a scam. They didn't really create that renewable energy. They bought it, and then they would move it around, and they'd get tax credits on the same amount, you know, same fuel multiple times, to the point where we're talking more than $400 million in fraudulent credits from the federal government. In the middle of this period of time, Washakie was not just buying advertisements, but they were donating to political campaigns, more than $100,000, more than $50,000 of which went to Attorney General Sean Reyes. Now, when the FBI raided their offices and the criminal case got undergoing, it's quite obvious that political reporters would ask the Attorney General, what are you going to do with that donation? What he said at the time was that he was putting it in escrow, essentially putting it in a bank account just to see what happened with the criminal case. The implication being that if a criminal action happened, he would get rid of that money. But if it turned out to just be bad charges, then maybe he would keep it. For years, we've been asking this, and repeatedly we've been told that that's what happened. His campaign manager, Alan Crooks, who's the one who would answer these questions, would also be rather mean about the questions, calling them stupid, saying he's not even going to give us a comment because he didn't think it was worth it. It was a ridiculous question, he would say.
It's a ridiculous question to ask what you're going to do with the money from this company involved in what amounts to a scam?
Yes.
Okay.
Just being very defiant. Well, then we found out that on the Attorney General's campaign website, right before Thanksgiving, they posted a clarification saying that by the time the campaign was contacted about the Washakie donation, this is back in 2016, the money had already been spent. Since the donation had been depleted, it was never put in escrow. Essentially, what we were told was a lie.
Okay, so, I mean, and that's interesting. And what is the, is there any sort of repercussion for that other than, you know, Robert Gehrke publishing a column in the Salt Lake Tribune?
No, obviously there's no rule or law violated by taking a contribution and spending it. But it politically looks bad. And there's plenty of examples we have of politicians taking money from someone who turns out to have done something criminal and then washing their hands of the situation by donating the money to somewhere else. Democrats did this with Harvey Weinstein and the allegations against that movie mogul of horrendous sexual assaults. There's plenty of Democrats who took the money and gave it to groups that fight those kind of issues. So there is examples here. What Robert Gehrke points out in his column is what he says is that what the Reyes campaign is saying is absurd on its face. The idea that they can't do anything because the money was spent. This is a campaign that has hundreds of thousands of dollars in their campaign coffers. No one expects them to take the actual dollar bills someone donates, put it in a box, and then say, well, those dollar bills have now been given away. We all understand how money works. They could have done an equivalent amount, and they could still do that today and make a donation of it and say, we took money from a group that was a criminal organization. We're the Attorney General. We don't want to be tied to that. So we're going to give an equivalent amount of money to some donation, some victim's fund, something.
Well,
right?
And Robert Gehrke suggests, I mean, one way to maybe make this right is because since those were renewable tax credits that were funded by taxpayers, that this go basically back into the
treasury.
Treasury, yeah.
Exactly. So their comments, the Reyes campaign's comments, just don't make sense.
Do you know what has happened so far to the people who made money through this scam? I mean, have they kept any of the profits that they've reaped? And what's happening I mean, there's one defendant left in the Washakie story, and what's happening there?
So that's really where we're at, is that through all this investigation, these years of criminal actions in courts, It all is culminating into a case that started this week. And the four members of the Kingston family have all pleaded guilty. They have not yet been sentenced because they're all participating in this case. And so how this case unfolds will affect their sentences. So the person on trial now is named Lev Derman. What he is alleged to have done is laundered this money that the Kingstons received from the federal government through his businesses. A lot of them had ties in Turkey. And
there was even an escape route for some of the founders of Washakie who to go and live in Turkey.
And live in Turkey. They actually had plane tickets and, you know, ties to the government there. This is a lot of money. And we're talking about them buying mansions and cars that cost $1.7 million. There was a lot of money moving around. What this trial and why we're very interested in it is not just what happens with Lev Derman, but the actual testimony of leaders of the Kingston Polygamy sect, which is a very closed sect that we have not learned a lot about their actions. They're going to be on the witness stand, and Lev Derman's attorneys are going to try to make them the bad guys by asking them questions about how they operate.
Okay. It should be interesting. This is a trial that's kicking off today, if I'm not mistaken, right?
We've had opening statements and one witness. It's actually going to pick up again on Monday, and so this is going to last into March potentially.
Okay. Really interesting story that you can check out at sltrib.com. One more reminder to weigh in with a thought or comment before we wrap up the show by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. But with that, I do want to turn now to our final segment, which is the underplayed stories of the week, a story where we maybe highlight a story that didn't get a lot of attention or that we just didn't talk about today on the program. And since we haven't heard from her in a little while, we will turn to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens for her pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, I'm going to highlight a piece my colleague Jessica Miller wrote this week about a proposal to dramatically change the way state judges are selected. This comes from Senator Dan McKay from Riverton. Basically, what it would do is subject judges to the nomination process to actually run, you know, as a candidate for that position. Some people are concerned that would politicize the judiciary. And Spencer Cox, our lieutenant governor, tweeted about it. He said, "It would be impossible for me to overstate what a terrible idea this is." So pretty interesting details in Jessica Miller's story on sltrib.com.
And one question that I have is why Dan McKay wants that to happen. Why does he think that that's a good idea? Is that in the story? I'll check it out at sltrib.com.
What he says in the story is essentially that the people should have a vote in our retention election process. And if you remember your ballots, sometimes there'll be a list of judges. He says it's a joke, that we ignore it. It doesn't really serve its purpose. And so there should be an actual race between two candidates, and people should have to think about it in electing our judges.
Okay. Find that story at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
I'm going to go with something that broke this morning. Lee Davidson wrote it for us. Representative Ben McAdams has endorsed Michael Bloomberg for president. This is interesting in part because the Salt Lake Tribune and our polling partners at Suffolk University have recently came out with a poll of which Democratic candidates are most likely to get Utah's delegates when we have our Super Tuesday primary here in March. And Bernie Sanders is the leading candidate in Utah, which is not too surprising since he won the primary, or at least the caucus, when we had a different system in 2016. In second place was Elizabeth Warren, showing how strong Utah's progressives are when it comes to the Democratic vote. Third was Joe Biden, and fourth was Michael Bloomberg. If anyone owns a TV, they know that Michael Bloomberg is advertising heavily in this state.
I've never heard the name.
Yes. and he's the only one doing so. Representative Ben McAdams, considers Mike someone who will get things done and work across party lines. He called him a moderate. The one thing they do have in common is they were both mayors, though of slightly different sized populations. Ben McAdams in Salt Lake County and Michael Bloomberg in New York City.
I guess one thing to think about here is that Ben McAdams' calculus on who to endorse probably has less to do with what the rest of progressive Democrats in Utah are thinking, given
For sure.
the state that he represents, right?
Yeah, and, you know, honestly, he doesn't have to endorse. He's making a decision of a candidate he supports. And I think if you're a presidential candidate, you are trying to get as many endorsements as you can at this stage. So I'm sure it means something.
Okay. That's Matt Canham's pick for Underplayed Story. I'm going to go with a story by the Tribune's Jessica Miller about dreamers, people who were brought to the country as children, who can now become attorneys in Utah thanks to a ruling by the Utah Supreme Court approving a rule. You can check that out and all of the stories that we have been talking about at sltrib.com. And I want to thank Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune, and Taylor Stevens, reporter with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to both of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org or through whatever app you use to get podcasts. And yeah, thanks as always to KCPW's Jesse Ellis for his help on the show and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan as well. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us and have a great weekend. We'll see you again next week.